I wish I did write a book, but I haven't yet. I'm trying to figure out how to do it without getting sued by Amazon. I could write about general management things, but like the interesting thing is like, oh yeah, this one time so-and-so yelled at somebody. And when I attribute things to Jeff or Dave Clark, I get a note from them.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It's been a crazy pandemic. I'm excited to be back here on the Warrior Poet Podcast. This is your host, Shri. In some previous episodes, I have sought to convey the lessons that I and others I knew learned at Amazon. Maybe you heard of it. Today, I interview Dave Glick, a 20-year Amazon veteran. And as you'll see, Dave was on the inside of many of the foundational principles, practices, and news stories of the early days of Amazon, and then as Amazon became a global behemoth. Dave is currently CTO of Flex, F-L-E-X-E, which I just saw 2 weeks ago was noted as Seattle's newest unicorn, meaning they exceeded $1 billion in valuation. Flex is an operations technology startup, and that is where I overlapped with Dave at Amazon. And dare I say, operations can learn a lot from technology, and technology can learn a lot from operations. I really hope you enjoy the interview with Dave. I know I did. Welcome here today, Dave. I wanted to start with something that I was actually working on today, which was thinking about how to instill in my teams not just a level of focus around goals, but around what some companies call how we work. And so I fell back to my training at Amazon, just like in the SEAL teams in the military, they say a lot, you know, you fall back on your training in certain scenarios. And so that happens in the private sector too. And I immediately started writing down tenets. And I remember a discussion when I first got to Amazon, debating with my very, very intelligent new boss what the difference between principles and tenets were. And I feel like tenets is one of those things that if you've been at Amazon, you know what they are, but they're really hard to define. I'm curious, A, if you can define it better than I ever could since you were at Amazon longer, and B, do you still value that process? And if not, how do you get what the goodness is there for your teams?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because one of my nicknames at Amazon was the Godfather of Tenets. And I wrote the first tenets. We were in a meeting with the big boss, and he started saying all these smart things. And he said, you know, we should put these, you know, things that I'm saying right at the top of the document every month so we don't have to rehash them. And it was actually quite funny. You know, and he said, is anybody writing this down? And I, like, everybody pulled out their notebooks and started scribbling. And so the next month I was writing a document, and it was on pricing, because I was in charge of pricing when we were meeting with him. And, you know, I wrote to the technical advisor and said, hey, you know, what were the exact words that Jeff used for these tenets? And so I, you know, we had 1 through 5, and I took the 5 that Jim sent me, and the first 3 I put in verbatim, and the 4th and 5th, I made them better. And we went back to the meeting with him next month. And he's like, these first 3 are great. The 4th and 5th need some work. And it was interesting because he didn't like remember what he said, but he had like the same inputs, the same outputs. And so he ended up with the first set of tenets were the pricing tenets. And every month we would have the pricing tenets at the top of the document. And we did that for about a year. And then Jeff said, we should have this for all programs. And the word went out. And, you know, a week later, everybody was writing tenets. And my friends called me and said, man, we hate you because we have to write these tenets. And can you send me your tenets? But, you know, the idea behind tenets is that they should be durable, and that you should be able to use them to make decisions. So rather than having to go up to your boss and his boss and her boss and all the way up to the CEO, you have agreed, you'd have your arguments up front, and you have, you know, vigorous discussion about what the tenets should be. And once they're decided, you know, they're very slowly changing. And so you can use those to make decisions. And, you know, the pricing tenets broadly were confidential, but Jeff paraphrased them in one of his HBR articles. So I can feel like I can share that. And what he said in HBR was, or HBR interviews, what he said was, you know, we keep prices low and economists come in and say they're too low. We do this because we believe that that builds customer trust. And then long-term customer trust leads to free cash flow. And so that was, we take it as an article of faith. And so that was the first tenet at Amazon. And so the idea was you should rate these tenets and you should discuss them and then you use them for decision-making. And, you know, I actually had guiding principles first and I changed it to tenets for some reason, but that's the idea. And, you know, most people write terrible tenets. I do too. Like the customer is always, you know, our customer is X, which is, you know, not terrible because you want to know who your customer is, but that doesn't help you necessarily make decisions. And so in my, you know, I'm at Flex now and we do not have tenets for every program, but we do sometimes sit around when we're having discussions, say we should go back to having tenets. And I'll often say, tenet one should be this. And I can come up with one good tenet or two good tenets for any program as we're talking about it. But, you know, five or six, it's really hard to come up with more than one or two.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're in the presence of greatness. I had no idea when I asked that question that you were the godfather of tenets. I will say, although I have no doubt that your friends and colleagues didn't enjoy what perhaps was a knee-jerk exercise for them to writing these down, by the time I had gotten there in 2014, so I'm not sure how much earlier this was that you and others introduced, but I actually noticed teams kind of getting excited about the opportunity to establish these up front, because I think there's a realization that by doing so, you are laying the groundwork for your own autonomy in a way, and to have those real debates up front rather than have them kind of debated in back rooms with senior leadership and maybe your boss without you being there or without anyone explicitly stating their assumptions and why they're advocating a certain position.
Yeah. And we were meeting this time in 2006. So it was a long time ago. And, you know, yeah, over the years, it became part of the culture. And, it, you know, the best thing that we can do as leaders is provide clarity for our teams. And our bosses, the best thing they can do for us is provide clarity. And I always refer to this book that I actually never read. It was called PeopleWare. I got it for one of my staff back in like 1999. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. But I think that the concept is, you know, think of the last software project you ever did or that failed. Last software project you ever worked on that failed. Was it because you didn't have the right hardware? Probably not. Was it because you didn't know how to write software? Probably not. Was it because the people couldn't give you clarity and they fought with each other and you didn't have the right people on the project? Probably. And so, you know, the biggest gift we can give to our teams is clarity.
Totally. Totally. I'll have to read the book. Your statement reminds me of, I think it's a Parks and Rec, Aziz Ansari, a Tom Haverford quote. You know, it reminds me of, you know, a book that was made into a movie, you know, that I never read or something like that. But I do agree that, you know, for what it's worth, a lot of times, as Naval Ravikant says, a lot of books can be reduced to a few paragraph blog post. So I think the clarity is certainly key there.
Yeah. I mean, most business books started out as a 6-page HBR article, and someone said, oh, this is great. Can you write 100 pages on it? And so they have 94 pages of fluff.
Right.
And then, you know, Blinkist has made a whole business out of summarizing these and reading them to you.
Right, right. It's funny. It goes from blog post to book and then back down to Blinkist summary. Like, we could have skipped a step. I guess, not to rabbit hole too much on the subject of tenets, but is there something to the 4, 5, 6 number of things? You know, I'm sure the intent is not to be too prescriptive or formulaic, right? So there's no point in doing a certain number to do a number. But you seemed like between the lines there that there was some dissatisfaction with only coming up with two. What's behind that?
You know, maybe a founder's effect where like we had 5 for pricing and everybody's like, I think we should have about 5. And you see some people will want to write a paragraph for each tenet or want to have 8. And they basically want to write a one pager in Tenet form, in bullet form. You know, I'm trying to think of some smart one I came up with just off the top of my head, and I can't think of it right now. But you'll be sitting, at, you know, along with clarity, the other thing you can give your team is focus. And usually Tenet 1 should be, you know, what's the most important thing you should accomplish from this? What is the goal of this project or this program? And, you know, as who is the customer? And, you know, in a startup, it may be like, our number one priority is not to run out of cash. And especially, you know, these times that's top of mind, right? Where the money's not free anymore. And, you know, that seems obvious, but it, potentially if you go into every meeting and you read the Tenet, our number one priority is not to run out of cash, you may make different decisions. When I was playing, I think EverQuest, someone said, the number one cause of dying in EverQuest is running out of hit points. And so you can say the number one cause of a startup going out of business is running out of cash. And, you know, so things like that are super simple, but put things front of mind.
Definitely. Definitely. You were at Amazon a long time. I was only there 4 years. Thoroughly enjoyed it. I like to say other places I didn't drink all the Kool-Aid, but there's a lot that perhaps obviously, perhaps not, that company is doing right. And one of the things that I really, really liked when I got there was the dedication to walking the walk when it comes to principles, and specifically as embodied through Amazon's leadership principles. And not only did folks from the top all the way to the bottom walk the walk in terms of talking about them, referencing them in debates about things, and having that permeate everything through the people processes of hiring and performance evaluation and promotion, but the actual substance in the principles, to me, really mapped well to what someone from the military was dedicated to, and how you ran things in life and for the mission that you were trying to solve. What can you talk a little bit about, you know, what you loved about Amazon culture, maybe some opportunity areas, and how much of that have you taken to Lex?
Yeah, you know, I really love the Amazon culture. And, you know, there are people who say it wasn't inclusive enough or that it was too hardcore, you know, for anything. For me personally, it was very good and it was great. I responded well to the culture. But, you know, the way I think about it is Amazon was good as telling you what to do, and you'd be a single-threaded leader, right? This is your mission, to use the military term, and then tell you how to do it, the leadership principles, and then give you continuous feedback, you know, in very direct ways if you were doing it well or not. And if you did it well and survived, you got promoted and you went from manager to senior manager. And then they would tell you, this is your mission. This is still how you do it, but maybe there's different ways a senior manager does that. And then you did that, director and VP and so on. And so for years we talked about, is Amazon a retail company or a technology company? And in 2015 or 16, I argued it was a logistics company, that Amazon is neither retail or technology. It was a logistics company. In retrospect, I think it's probably the greatest leadership development program ever created. And they took the GE, a lot of the GE thoughts, and put them on steroids and made them more direct, made them more well-defined with the leadership principles. I was telling one of my friends this, and he's a West Point guy. So he said, the only other one that competes is Army. And you may say the Navy as well. I don't know. But the idea of if you put a smart MBA or a smart tech leader into this thing and they stay there 8 years, get two promotions and a bar raiser, they're probably, you know, the output will probably be really good. Like you can hire someone. And that was something I just made up, 8 years, two promotions and a bar raiser. I posted that on LinkedIn and got a lot of positive feedback. And, you know, you're going to hire a director and you know exactly what they're going to do for you and how they're going to do it. At Flex, we, you know, interestingly, you know, and we talked to a bunch of startups I advise and I've talked to around the Seattle area. Many of them have a very similar set of leadership principles to Amazon. We have a bunch of Amazon folks, but we moved away from the Amazon leadership principles sort of purposely because, you know, from a, you know, lots of people have lots of opinions about Amazon from the outside in and from the inside out. And, you know, we wanted to focus more on being an inclusive environment, like explicitly. And, you know, Amazon has earned trust, which sort of speaks to inclusion. But for the most part, you know, there's deep dive, disagree and commit, deliver results, all rank higher than that. You know, my opinion again. So, you know, we wanted to put, you know, working together as a leadership principle or as a core value, make it better. You know, one of the ones that I really liked of our core values is seek solutions. Like, we want people who seek solutions, not just, you know, complain or not just tell you the problems. And the other one that I really like is jump in. Like, we like people who run towards the fire. And this was particularly important in the early days when I joined, where we'd have, you know, we ended up putting a bunch of people on a plane on Black Friday to get through that weekend when, you know, the partner we were working with didn't have enough staff. So we put people on the plane, we jumped in, and we, you know, we saved the business.
I like it. I like it. That's an awesome story. I will say I agree. Things like earn trust. I don't know anyone who was at Amazon who would rank that as high. I think probably both in terms of what the practical application was at Amazon and how people got rewarded, but also maybe just the personalities of those people. I don't know that they would rank those things like that as highly either in terms of their ladder of importance generally, but having been at some high performing startups after Amazon and then the military experience before that, definitely I've seen, let's call them, you know, different configurations of the principles that work quite well, especially with regard to collaboration and that earned trust principle, the way people work together. I think another one is kind of where ideas come from. Like, who owns the agenda exactly? And I think for me at Amazon, after a couple few years there, I started to, like, I love the press release FAQ process. People come up with great ideas all the time from the bottom up. But the day-to-day, week-to-week of that company, to me, is a command and control company. And I don't mean that completely negatively. I just think it's not a sort of kumbaya, ideas come from the bottom, you know, sort of thing. And I think if someone tries to map that onto their own startup, like, maybe it worked well when Jeff was, you know, in the garage in the warehouse, you know, for him. But, like, I don't think that maps well onto much younger companies with, you know, trying to, especially in that pre-product market fit space. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on that and where you see teams coming up with winning ideas, how you configure the culture to get that.
Yeah, you know, I've found that I'm a very good operator, not as good big thinker. You know, if you think about that as a leadership principle. And what I found is mostly the engineers know what is broken. You know, from an operational standpoint, like, we should not tell them, you need to go fix this. We should say, we empower you to make your lives better. And that always worked for me. And you know, when I would join a new team, usually things are broken, because if they weren't broken, I wouldn't be there, or, you know, the previous leader would have been there. And so the first thing I always have to do is say, you know, what should we fix to the engineers? And they would say, oh, you know, this is the biggest source of our trouble. And I'm like, okay, well, why don't you go fix that? I had a guy work for me who was one of the best employees. His name is Bali Raghavan, who's eventually gone off to be CTO at different startups. And he had been recently promoted to manager. I was a senior manager. And he came into the office and said, you know, Dave, we've been rolling out new features. And we thought when the features were done being rolled out, then we would go clean up our operational excellence and operational problems. And the team just met, and we decided that that's never going to happen, that we're never going to not have new features to roll out. And so we are demanding from you that we are allowed to do operational support and operational excellence work every sprint. And I said, hallelujah. Like, yes, that's exactly what I want you to do. Thank you, Bali, for putting it in such a crisp way. And so, you know, the leadership, you know, the other thing I had, I took over Amazon Fulfillment Technologies, which was a big team. It was about 500 people, half of which were in the engineering team. And it was a terrible place to work. They were losing people because the operational load was so high. And there was one of the guys said, you know, the problem is that Victor's mom can put in a ticket to us. Like, can you imagine every customer being able to put into a ticket to the website team without going through customer service? But for the FCs, you know, everyone could put in a ticket. And so we had huge operational load. And, you know, I was in the meeting with the managers and they said, well, senior management won't let us, you know, clean up our house. And I was like, wait a minute, who's senior management? Who is the senior management of which you speak? And I'm like, because Dave Clark's only told me one thing. He's like, you get Kiva done and then run your shop. And so I don't feel like I'm being told that I can't do the right thing. And so we talked a bit and I realized I was senior management and that they had projected on me and on this boogeyman senior management that they weren't being allowed to do what they thought was the right thing. And at the time we also were expanding headcount, which made it easier, and we built a support team. But you know, I went back to them and said, hey, if you feel like you're doing the wrong thing, stop doing the wrong thing and come talk to me, or, you know, talk to the director, talk to me. And, you know, sometimes we'll say, yep, got to do it. Like we were doing the Kiva integration at the time. That was like the ships were burnt. Like there was no negotiation on that. But we had, you know, 200 engineers on the team. And so not everybody was working on that. And so I don't think anyone ever came to my office and said, we're doing the wrong thing. But they did take ownership and say, oh, we have the, you know, we are now empowered to do, you know, come with our own ideas and figure out what to do is the right thing. And, you know, we saw tickets reduce, you know, significantly over time. And then, you know, Q4 came, which was our big, you know, we wanted to have no Sev1s in Q4. And we had, I think the previous year we had 20 in December or something. And we had gone through an exercise where each team had to write up their plan. And my staff and I read each one of them and gave feedback. And they hated it. They were like, oh, this is bureaucracy. And then they appreciated two things. You know, they came back after Christmas, said, one, you spent the time reading all 40 of these documents. We really appreciate that you didn't make us do this and then don't read them. Two, we went from 20 Sev1s to 2 Sev1s year over year in that time. And so we were sitting around waiting for tickets to come in and they never came. And so they appreciated that it actually worked. And that built, again, you know, I don't know if I poo-pooed earned trust, but like, that build trust, and earn trust is actually super important. And it's different ways at different companies, but like being able to work with people you trust, and I'm not always, you know, I don't always earn trust, but I, you know, try to. Being able to work with people you trust makes the whole thing a ton easier.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that you said there stuck with me around the story of people looking at senior management and you know, that person won't let us do this, or they, right? The infamous yeah. They. Implicitly there seems to be a level of have backbone and kind of, you know, asking why, you know, in operations terminology, you know, the five whys of the Toyota production system, like, is kind of informative there. And especially you've done a ton of operations technology. So all that kind of operations leadership stuff, I think probably is part and parcel of what you've probably been working with for a long time. But I face the same thing in tons of situations, different companies, where teams assume that they can't do something, whereas there are some people who just innately assume they can or ask why. Maybe there's sometimes a level of arrogance there, perhaps, but I've always been one of those people who assumes that, you know, there's other people around me who are smart, there's people above me who are smart, but I'm, you know, I'm reasonably smart myself, or I wouldn't be here, and quite empowered to question the status quo. You know, I won't ask you to play kind of psychologist here, but how much do you intentionally seek to get that other type of person on the team? Or how much do you believe that you can instill that? And what, aside from kind of by example, as people bring things to you or as they say things, kind of correcting them, how do you encourage them to have that backbone? Because just for me, you know, with my roots in the military, kind of there's like it's disproportionately the other direction where people are running to the fire, people are asking why, especially in the SEAL teams. But it's very much not the case in the private sector, and that's fine. But there's a lot to be gained from that.
Hey, gang. Hope you're enjoying this episode of The Warrior Poet. If you are, don't forget to subscribe so I can get you more thoughts on leadership, interviews with military experts and business phenoms, as well as other hacks to up your game in your daily life. And please leave a review. Let me know what I'm doing well, which interviews you'd like, and if you like the philosophical musings, footnotes, or critiques of throwback music. Back to the interview.
A few things, you know, and I'm going to go speak at our tech summit where all the engineers are coming to town, many of whom I haven't met. I'm going to do that next week. I haven't written my presentation yet, but like, I'm going to put this in and say, like, we love people who come up with ideas and who are pitching to solve problems. And I think it's a paradox because, you know, whether you're at Amazon or where at a company that's like every customer is the most, you know, every new customer needs some work. You know, it is very easy to fall into the trap of driving dates and top-down leadership. And so I think it's important, and this has reminded me, like, I relearn lessons all the time, unfortunately. You know, I always worry when I go on a podcast that people who work for me will listen to it and say, well, he doesn't do that. So I want to be mindful that I'm picking my greatest hits, which were like things that worked, but I need to have a one-on-one with myself sometimes and teach myself to do this. But the other thing I heard on a podcast or something, I don't think they called them podcasts, it was like Fresh Air, I think, on NPR. Someone said they were talking about Bob Dylan, and they said, Bob Dylan's the guy with the pen. And there's music all around us floating in the ether. And Bob Dylan's the guy who captured that and ran it through his pen and wrote it down. And so I kind of feel that way about myself. There's good ideas coming from my bosses. There's good ideas coming from the staff. There's good ideas sometimes I come up with. But for the most part, I'm the guy with the pen. And my superpower is to find that good idea that someone came up with and like say, how are we going to do that? And simplify, and, you know, because complexity is the end of us, right? You have a, you know, I had a boss who said, you know, I've got a 2x3. It was like an advanced MBA move, right? Not a 2x2, a 2x3. And it was like speed and, you know, speed and something else. And, you know, he had 6 boxes and we were living in all 6 of those. And I'm like, you know, this one where I have to ship 2 billion brown boxes, I'm going to spend my time in box 1. Because I got to ship 2 billion brown boxes. And it seems like until you tell me otherwise, that's what I'm going to go do. And, you know, to me, if I can provide my team with that clarity of the mission, that's the best thing that I can do.
That's awesome. By the way, I used to listen to Fresh Air with Terry Gross all the time. So great, great show. I need to re-listen to it. I had a kind of breakfast meeting with an engineering leader over Zoom this morning, and he had a big sign behind him that said simplify. So clearly your message, it resonates with a lot of people, especially in technology, but I think probably everywhere.
I love that. I had a guy who worked for me who ran all of our infrastructure. Great guy, but he was kind of all over the place. And I had him said, I want you to print out 3 things on a piece of paper in 72 point font. Like, install cameras here, make sure the network runs, and then do what Dave tells you to do. I said, print that out, put it on your mirror, read it every morning when you're shaving. And, you know, and because that was the top 2 priorities of the company, or of, you know, like, he was trying to get promoted. I was trying to get promoted. My boss had told me that Jeff wants cameras in the building. And I told him, I want the network to stay up. And so I don't want you to think about anything else except for those things. And, you know, we got those things done.
What can operations learn from technology? And maybe the inverse question, it could be interesting too, or maybe these questions mean nothing, and I'm just being too clever by half here. But given that you've lived at the intersection of operations and technology and had the opportunity and privilege to work with people from both sides and gain that expertise in this niche, I'm curious what each sets of people and functions can learn from each other.
A couple things. One is, you know, the ops folks are the ones who came up with operational excellence, right? Came from Toyota and Six Sigma and Lean and all these things. And we brought that to technology. So that's the biggest thing. At Amazon in particular, we were expected to have COEs and 5Ys, and we had an Andon cord, and, you know, we looked at ticket counts and defect rates and all those things. So I think that's the biggest thing we learned. You know, one of the learnings I had, this was before I was in ops, I was in pricing. We were setting prices and doing promotions, and we'd have pricing errors. And we had, you know, dozens of them in a year, and they're like the most expensive thing you can have, right? If you sell an iPad for $1 instead of $1,000, you're going to, you know, and you're putting things on a truck 30 minutes later, it's hard to get back from that. And so we had, you know, a couple dozen incidences, and I put, you know, a TPM single threaded on it because I was getting the pushback. And so he went and classified all these things. And like, what we learned, and what we learn every time, is humans are great defect injectors. Like, when you look for defects, you will almost always find them being injected by a human. It is also true that humans are great defect handlers. And so what oftentimes people will try to do is put in robotics or put in, you know, take the defect handlers out of the systems without taking the defect injectors out of the systems. And so it's important to first take the defect injectors out of the system, because robots will do exactly what you tell them to do. And you know, they say garbage in, garbage out. And so if you've got the wrong dimensions on an item, or if you have the wrong price, you know, or any of those things, they will do, the robots will do them, the robots or the systems will do them at scale very quickly. And so you can get yourself into trouble. So, you know, having, you know, another one is poke. I don't know if you've heard the term poke yoke, but the idea is defect proofing, or I don't think we say idiot proofing, but like making it so you can't screw it up. And so that's a way to build systems, because humans are 99% machines. And so if you want to have a system that's more than 99% correct, you need to be build systems and poke yokes and around that, so that errors that humans will make because they're human are caught and detected and fixed at the point.
Awesome. Tons to learn there. That was really insightful. Something else along the ops tech line as well that I was thinking about and wanted to pick your brain on. I love, especially maybe it's my personality, personal taste or experience at Amazon or the military, but I really like the intersection of tangible things with technology. Clearly you do too, or you wouldn't still be doing that at Flex. Obviously, I don't want to dismiss the amount of complicated software that is helping to optimize that is, you know, very abstract and very digital. But at the same time, I'm curious, like I'm in machine learning right now for a few years, despite, you know, that interest in the tangible world. We, you know, software is eating the world, right? As I think Mark Andreessen said that, but it's been eating the world for operations for a very, very long time. How much juice have we squeezed out of that opportunity area? Again, obviously you're a Flex for a reason. I don't expect you to kind of, you know, talk off that track. There's probably lots there, but you know, for people who are earlier in their career and kind of, you know, thinking about the purely digital routes in front of them versus otherwise, I'm just curious kind of, you know, where you see the opportunities.
Yeah. Well, I had a principal engineer who came to work for me in AFT, Amazon Fulfillment Technologies. He said, I have a physics degree. I like moving things from here to there. I also have several physics degrees, and I like moving things from here to there. The thing that I really enjoy about both in retail and in ops is you get to meet your customers. They're actually people that you can go, you can fly to Fresno and walk around a warehouse and see the people using their software, your software, as opposed to if you're running a website, you never meet your customers. They're sort of nameless, faceless consumers. And lots of people will say, you know, either we want consumer experience in this role, or, you know, I want to work on a consumer product, you know, I want to own a P&L. You know, I kind of think of myself as sort of blue collar software, you know, working with the warehouses. This is, you know, it's putting boxes on trucks and making sure the right things are in boxes. And so, you know, that gives me gratification. And, you know, I ventured a little bit into the AI space, but never really got deep in it. I mean, you know, what I found that almost everybody who says AI or ML doesn't know what they're talking about. I mean, there's Elon Musk and his driving cars, and there's, you know, the Just Walk Out technology, which Dilip runs at Amazon, and, you know, and a variety of people are working at scale using machine learning. And I think it's getting more and more because, you know, AWS and GCP and so on are building tools for that, and there's more data available. But, like, we would do projects where we were, oh, we need to use machine learning for this, and then, you know, we'd send it to the economist and he'd come back and say, you know, here are the coefficient, you know, give me a bunch of data and I'll give you the coefficients for which are the most important things. And that's basically linear regression, you know, multivariate linear regression. And when I would talk to the AI folks, I always thought when I started, oh, unsupervised learning, we'll just put all the data in there and see what pops out. And, you know, we'll get 1,000 variables and see what pops out. And I'd go talk to the AI experts and they'd say, you know, what do you think are the most important variables? You know, tell me what the 5 most important variables you think, and we'll put those into our system, and we'll have them, you know, nicely supervised and ground truthed, and you know, we'll have the 5 inputs and 1 output, and you know, that got you, you know, 90%+ of the way there. You know, not to, you know, I do think that, you know, Tesla is going to, you know, the Tesla folks are saying software ate the world, and now neural nets are going to eat software. And I think that is true of sort of high transaction, high data things. But, you know, for putting boxes on trucks, you know, if you're doing 10,000 units a day or, you know, 100,000 units a day, like, I don't know if you've got enough, your N is high enough to really do deep machine learning. And, you know, I have people on my team who disagree, and I hope and pray that they will prove me wrong, because that'll give us a competitive advantage.
I'm sure there's a Dilbert cartoon that depicts something along the lines of the data scientists asking you the questions instead of the other way around.
I put a post on LinkedIn, a joke I heard once that was, when you're talking to engineers, you say AI. When you're talking to investors, you say ML. No, when you're talking to engineer, well, one of those. And when you're actually doing it, it's spreadsheets. And I got like 100,000 views and, you know, 1,000 likes. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, no, we've got a little bit of time left. You, based on your LinkedIn posts and this conversation, clearly take the craft of leadership seriously. When, you know, maybe early in your career, can you talk about a leader who had a profound impact on you, and, you know, why that was?
You know, one of the people I was telling someone just yesterday, his name was Suresh Kumar. He's now the chief technology officer at Walmart. So he's gone from Amazon and Microsoft to Google to Walmart, and it done very well for himself. And, you know, one of the things I always remember him saying was, look, I put together a plan and I'm going to march down that plan half a step per day. If he's going one step per day, the expectation is too high. And so he would keep us focused on, you know, what we need to accomplish, how we marching down this roadmap to redo supply chain or redo retail at Amazon. And he frustrated some of his colleagues because they'd have things that weren't part of his plan, that they would want him to create an API for this, or, you know, we had to upgrade to the new Linux version or something. And he would want to be one of the last people who would engage on that, because he's like, I'm trying to redo the supply chain for Amazon.com. And so he would march a half step a time every day. And then when the pressure got too high, he would stop what we're doing, go relieve the pressure, whether it was an upgrade on Linux or creating an API for someone. And then he'd go back to marching half step forward on his plan. And so I always respected him a ton. And because he had that focus. The other thing he would do, another thing he taught me, is I would write these documents for, you know, the higher ups. And he would always come in like, you know, the day before, and I'd been struggling for weeks writing these documents or this document. And he'd say, no, man, that's too complicated. It's three sentences. Always start with three sentences. You know, we are going to do this. This is how we're going to do this. This is what we're going to do, or whatever. Start with your three sentences and then build the six pager around it. And, you know, sometimes at first he would come and dictate behind me. It's like, write this. But he was an expert at simplification. I guess that's where I learned simplification.
When you look at yourself and how you lead teams, what are the things that you consider your strengths and the things you like to double down on? And maybe, you know, if you don't mind sharing, what are some of the, you know, kind of anti-patterns or kind of, you know, things that take a little more, you know, we talked about simplification. We've also talked on this show right now, repetition, whether that be repeating the same blog post for 200 pages in a book or repeating it to your teams, what the mission is, kind of what's that talk track to
yeah,
yourself?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I like is hiring and teaching, and then also simplifying. And so, you know, I made a LinkedIn post the other day that was, give me any problems and I'll tell you the answer is either simplify or hire your way out of it. And that comes down to the single-threaded leader at Amazon. Like, you know, hire someone to be single-threaded on that problem and they will fix that problem. So those are the things that I get passionate about. The anti-pattern I have is that I don't like to get in the business. Like, once I've hired my team and I trust my team, I like to let them run. And I'm like, well, there's, you know, two or three layers of smart people between me and the problem. They probably have it figured out. And so I'll sometimes sit back. And one of my bosses told me, you know, when the house is on fire, I never worry about you. When everything's going well, that's when I worry about you not being engaged enough. And so, you know, one time at Amazon, and, you know, I was a VP, I had VPs working for me, you know, whole layers and layers of leadership. And we were getting beat up by one of our customer teams. And, you know, they had gone to my boss and me and said, like, you know, we have to fix these 10 things. And so we agreed, we wrote the 10 things, you know, they said, if we fix these 10 things, everything would work. And we wrote the 10 things on the board. And again, this is where I was getting feedback to be more engaged. So I sat with the senior manager of tech and the product manager, and we had a TPM assigned, and, you know, and there were people from the customer too. So probably 8 of us on the working team. I met with them for, I had a team of 3,000 people, but I would met for an hour a day with this team. And we made so much progress because one example was the engineering leader came in and said, yeah, I know how to fix this. And the PM said, okay, well, we'll have a BRD to you by Tuesday. I'm like, well, Rob says he can fix it today. It's Thursday. Why does he have to wait till Tuesday? They're like, well, we have to, you know, we don't have time to write the BRD. And I'm like, well, does Rob, do you know what you need to do? So yes. Julian, does Rob know what he needs to do? It's like, yes. Like, okay, well, let's sit here for the next 15 minutes. And, you know, BRD is just a bunch of background and some bullet points. And so, like, let's skip the first part and let's just write the bullet points and Rob can go do this tomorrow. And, you know, part of me was worried that they would say, oh, you're micromanaging. So the output was, like, we did in 6 weeks what would have taken us 6 months to do. And I worried that I micromanaged and would take ownership away and autonomy away from my team. But the feedback I got from the team was, like, we hadn't seen you this engaged in years. We need to do more of this. We appreciate being in the room with you. And so that's probably my Achilles heel, is that I will under the guise, either perceived or real, that I want to give ownership to my team, I can end up pulling back too far. And the fact is that I do have value to add in solving these problems. And when I do go to, like, the working meetings, I see the notes the next day, and some of the things that I mentioned were in the notes as things people were going to do. So that's a reminder for me that I need to stay engaged.
I really appreciate that, Dave, all the transparency and self-reflection there, self-awareness. It's a good general lesson to myself and everyone else. Last question. What advice would you give someone who's a brand new leader? So that, you know, for people like myself coming from the Naval Academy, you're kind of a leader on day one once you graduate and get to your ship or your unit, and you've got all these people below you. Granted, for those folks, they've had at least a few years of kind of leadership school, if you will. The private sector doesn't really work like that, doesn't equip people well enough usually, unless you're in a lucky spot. So, you know, maybe you're a software developer and all of a sudden you're a manager or some sort of lead, you get some direct reports, or, you know, in a warehouse, and you're great at, you know, picking those things off shelves, and all of a sudden you're so great at it that they want you to lead other people. What advice do you give that person?
I mean, I think I have lots of advice, but probably the best thing someone ever told me is, don't be afraid of your team. Don't be afraid of your people. And that as a young leader, I certainly did this, and most do. Oh, you know, if I give that person some hard feedback or any critical feedback, they're going to quit, or they won't like me, or something. And what I have found is every time I've sat down and given someone thoughtful feedback, they have thanked me. There was a guy who was super smart, but had a bunch of behavioral problems who worked for me when I was young. And I'm like, oh, but we can't lose him, because, you know, if I give him feedback or I tell him not to do that, you know, maybe he's going to quit. And one weekend I just sat down and said, like, what do I really want from Ed? And I, like, sat in a dark room and I, like, spent half an hour thinking about, like, what feedback can I give him and what advice or what suggestions can I give him to action that feedback? And not just like, man, you can't do that, but like, here's another way to approach that. And I wrote it up, and it wasn't like a performance review. It was like a personal development plan. And he knew that I'd spent time thinking about him. And his roommate told me the next day, he's like, oh my God, Ed talked about your meeting all the way home as we drove home for an hour, and he was so excited that you took the time and, you know, you cared about him. And so, again, lessons that get learned over and over again is that if, like, giving people feedback that is thoughtful, helpful, actionable is the kindest thing that you can do and will make them better. And again, as I mentioned before, you know, my boss gave me the feedback, like, when the house is on fire, I don't worry about you. When it's not, I do. And so, and I repeat that, you know, to this day. And so I think the most important thing is sort of going from being a assigner of tasks to a teacher to a mentor, to a developer of people. I had a boss, Kim Rackmiller, who gave me the advice, as you're getting more senior, product, process, people. So first level manager or engineer one, you don't have anything to do. You can't add any value except for the typing you do on the keyboard. When you're sleeping, you're not adding value. As you move to be manager, you're building processes that make the SDE1s more successful, and you have operational excellence and ticket reviews and roadmap thing and those kind of things. Then when you get to director, you're focused on your people, right? How do you develop people? How do you hire people, put them in the right place, organize? And then as a VP or a senior VP or a CEO, that's more and more all you do. And you have to work through the people on you. I'm going to say one more thing. I know we're close to time. I was in a meeting with Jeff Wilkie once, who was a great leader. And he was talking to one of the engineering leaders and said, I want you to repeat back to me what our priorities are, because I know that the priorities I want are not going to get done. The priorities you want, because you meet with these people every day, will get done. So I want you to repeat back to me what we have agreed upon here so that I know that my priorities are getting done, or that I know what the priorities are that are getting done. And I thought that was so insightful, because you have to work through people. And so, you know, I don't love the word getting aligned, but having alignment, having clarity on what's going to be done is something that he was high on.
Yeah, when I was working for Amazon Fresh, my boss used the word align so much that word today, to this day, still grates on me. But the principle makes sense. And Dave, really appreciate those examples. Those are wonderful examples for people to pick apart and pattern match and learn from experience. And I will say, I consider myself someone who's very, very schooled in leadership and takes it seriously as a craft, as a profession, as I like to call it, that stands on its own independent from product management or engineering management or anything else. But the don't be afraid of your team lesson that you stated right there is perhaps the most unique lesson that I've ever heard anyone utter. So that's gonna stick with me for a very long time. Really, really appreciate you joining us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Rainiac Productions. If you like The Warrior Poet, there's more great content on Instagram. Follow Shri, The Warrior Poet, on Instagram. That's S-R-I, The Warrior Poet. You can also get to know me on a personal level by following Shri, actually, on Instagram as well. The Warrior Poet is produced by Laddie, with special contributions by Spoonman and me, Shri.
No, 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 no. Kevin. Mina dua. Spita.
Ah!